Hi, I'm Trish Englund, and welcome to Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. Did you know all our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and new also on the Internet Archive, archive.org. We've got a really special event tonight, a roundtable discussion about Camel Lights, GTP Light Series from 1985 to 1993. The class called Camel Lights was a result of a brainstorm in 1984 between John Bishop and Jim Downing to form a new class of prototype cars that would be less expensive to build and campaign, not factory dependent, and accessible to a wider group of drivers and teams. They envisioned a parallel to the European Group C2 cars, but with different engine specs. The name Camel Lights was suggested by Downey's crew chief, Steve Conover, whom I know, who happened to smoke lights. It stuck and became the title of the class. So people got creative with a wide variety of engines and independent chassis builders. The new cars had exciting and exotic names, some that had been around for a while but had waited for their time in the American sun. Spice, Kudzu, Argo, Alba, Tiga, and Fab Car. What is it, Tiga or Tiga?
Tiga.
Who cares?
I do. I don't care. Just don't tell me. Jim and John went on to formulate the rule structure for the class that was introduced at Daytona at the start of the 85 season. So tonight, we've got a bunch of serious competitors from back in the day. Jeff Klein, back in the day. Yeah, we're all in rocking chairs. Jeff Klein, a wild man in a Pontiac Spice. Tom Hessert, driving for Essex Racing. Tim McAdam, who won the 24 in a Kudzu DG2 with Jim Downing and went on to pilot a whole list of Fab Car CLs. Don Bell was also a successful in Spice and Kudzu. Rick Noop, who can drive anything anywhere. Howard Cherry, who made a career of driving Fab Car CLs. Jack Webster, who documented everything. John Higgins, a winner in the famous White Island Spice. And Steve Durst, a hot shot in Spice for the Ball Brothers teams. And maybe a few more might show up. Incidentally, okay. So, I'm going to turn this over to Jeff Klein. He walks the talk and walks the talk. So, audience, please mute your phones. And another thing, when you speak, I'm speaking to all of you guys here, announce yourself. Tell us your names before you speak, because everyone, including me, won't remember your voice. So that'll make it go a lot smoother if you don't mind introducing yourself every time you start something. Okie dokie, mute your phones and have a good time. Jeff, take it away.
Nice job so far, Jeff.
Yeah. You're giving us dead air here.
Yeah, right. He must be with Howard.
He's at Jeff's in La La Land, California.
That's right.
That explains a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, don't put us Californians all in the same boat here. Let me call Jeff. He seems to have fallen off here.
That happens sometimes.
Can you guys continue the conversation, will you please?
Yeah, just go ahead. Let's see. What can we start with? How many of you started in 85 in lights?
Probably only down L.A. Forbes Robinson.
Don Bell there. We started in 85.
Yeah, Tom Winters.
I know you did.
Tom Winters.
I'm talking about the people we got here right now.
Oh. Maybe Don
Steve,
Bell. And
Steve Durst started in 85 with Essex.
Really?
Yep.
He's a peach. I love him.
Tom Hessert, I think I started in 86 with Steve Durst. And if you, Steve, remember that Harrier we bought.
Yeah, I remember it very well. Yeah.
I think we only did one race, and then it went in the trash can.
I don't remember that car at all.
Well,
that's
neither
probably
do we.
Better. We must have had close to $30,000 in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this is Di Bell. We paid $35,000 for one of the first Argos. I think they built about six of the JM16s. And I bought one. Charles Morgan bought one. I think Jim Downing had a couple of them, I believe.
Yeah, he's had a few. And he won three championships with it.
He did.
With the 16s. Yeah.
St. James bought one with a Cosworth, a DFG, I think it was. But that wasn't a light car. That was a GTP car. Well, we didn't buy them as light cars. We bought them as GTP cars.
Right.
So we were up against, it turned out to be about 962s or some big number of 962s. So our best place finish was if a couple of GTP cars broke 962s, we might be able to get a fourth, fifth, or sixth. But we started for the first couple of years, I think I went 2 years as GTP before we downsized the motors and went to Camel Lights.
Well, that's why Jim approached Mr. Bishop about this thing. He was getting tired of being run over by GTPs in the Argo.
Yeah. Well, so much for the lightweight spec. Give me a turbocharger or cubic inches anytime. Can't beat them.
Well, in 85, I drove for Clayton Cunningham, the Malibu Grand Prix, and we built a we bought Momo's old Alba. I shouldn't say we. He bought Momo's old Alba, and they took the Cosworth out. I think they bought it without an engine, and then some guy spent 4 months making a bulkhead for it, and they put a 13B Mazda in it. It was actually pretty good. We won two races in it, but we didn't start till later. Charlotte was my first race, and Ira Young, the team owner, was supposed to drive with me, and I remember I drove the first hour and a half, and I came in, and I had to go to the bathroom like no tomorrow, so he got in the car, spun three times behind the yellow flag, and when I got out of the bathroom, they put me back in the car, and that was the last time he ever drove it.
Oh, my gosh.
And I think Del Russo Taylor bought the car, and I don't know what the heck he did with it, but someone told me that there was the Alba was sitting on a street in Florida somewhere in front of the guy's house.
Oh, for heaven's sake. That's a name I haven't heard in a long time.
Yeah,
you got out of the car to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Howard just peed in the seat.
Hey, well, later, I'm back on here. This is Howard Cherry, and I got to protect myself here.
Yeah,
it is true.
You peed in the seat, Howard. You peed in the seat every time you got in the car.
Well, only the mechanic, too.
Well, you told everyone. Everyone must have known, right?
Now everybody does know.
Hey, Higgy, I often wondered, I mean, you and Tim and Howard and Chip, you were all buddies, right, before racing. Did you go to school together or did you grow up together? What's the connection?
No, we were in prison.
Yeah.
We were working for John Paul. We were his truck driver.
I wonder why you always walk funny. It was prison.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. we had a great time.
Actually,
Chip Mead and I were both from Dayton, and Chip was running Formula Atlantic cars with Ray Hall and Sullivan and all these guys in Canada with James King, and Howard was racing Atlantic cars also. So I met Howard through James and Chip in the late 70s.
Tim, when did you get involved?
Well, Tim was Chip's prep school roommate when they were in prep school.
Oh, I got it.
So that's how that group kind of hooked up. And we still hanging around together.
Hey, this is Steve Durst. Why don't you guys fill us in how Lorenzo Lamas came to be part of your group?
Well, because
you would bring that up. Seeing the car coming around in flames.
Yeah. That Lorenzo Lamas was an episode that we got into because he had a sponsor that was going to buy a second car to run him and Terry King. And they talked us in building a second car, and they kept promising the money was coming from a big cable television, South American cable television company. So we kept building, we kept putting money in. We get to Daytona, and he still hadn't paid us. And his representative showed up, and he was driving a Monte Carlo jacked up in the back with great big tires on it.
Was that big goof Mike?
Yeah,
Mike Ballou.
Ballou.
That was Mike Ballou.
Mike
Ballou,
that's
right.
I turned around and looked at the other guys, and I said, "We are screwed."
And were you?
Mike Ballou was Lorenzo's handler, and every time you'd need Lorenzo to do something, Ballou would have him over at some grocery store autographing cans of Kellogg's for $3,000 or something.
That's right. That's right.
Jeez.
Well, even my grandson,
But at least Lorenzo was a nice guy. He was a little bit emotional to be driving a car. John can tell you about the time he left the pits at West Palm Beach with the crew holding the tail engine cover of the car in their hands.
I was sitting on the pit wall with Ray Hall, and we were watching him go by lap after lap with absolutely no tail section, wing, or anything on the car. He had no idea.
Made no difference, right?
No. And we had such a camaraderie between us as drivers, and that we were always really kind to each other, because I can remember numerous times when on the starting grid, Durst would open my door and tell me he hopes to get me out before the fire gets too intense.
Yikes.
Well, you guys,
lawyers told me to do that.
Yeah, right.
Steve, do you remember the time I sent you the box of cat shit?
No wonder that tasted so bad. I never knew that.
I thought
they were Whitman samplers.
I cleaned out my cat box and sent it to Durst's office and asked him if he could inspect it because we suspected our cat of chewing our Oriental rugs.
That's too bad. Well, you guys were the most fun because every time there was a cocktail party, I'd say to Judy, "We're going to go to a cocktail party tonight," and she'd say, "I'm only going if the Fab Car guys are there." You know,
we were extremely highly prized possession of the Porsche Motorsports team. Al Holbert hated us so bad that he wouldn't even walk by our garage without crying.
Jack here back in 87 when we came in second to Daytona, and then we happened to go, we win Miami, and then we win Sebring. Boy, that put Porsche in a tough spot because they had to support us then.
Yeah, they hated it. Bob Carlson set the deal up, and Holbert hated it. You know, and then we get to Watkins Glen, and they chartered some big fancy boat. And you had to have a special pin, Porsche pin to get on the boat for the cruise around Seneca Lake. And we showed up with a bunch of bar bimbos we picked up, and they had our badges on, and we got on the boat, and they were all rowdy and everything, and that was another endearment to Mr. Holbert. He loved us.
Well, I remember a boat trip on Watkins Glen. I think it was that boat trip that Mr. Happy came up. And Judy still talks about that boat trip.
Well, you know, the reality of it is and we really had fun. I mean, we went from Miami, Florida to Vancouver. It's like nobody had a whole lot of money except for Bell. And we didn't have any money, and we didn't really have a great support system, but it was fun as shit, and it was like a traveling carnival, and it was really a great time. I mean, it was a lot of fun.
So I got a question for John Higgins. Is there any truth to that story? Because I came down, this is Doc.
No.
I came down by your pit one night about 10 o'clock at night, 24-hour race, and everybody was bitching and angry because supposedly, I said this couldn't happen, but supposedly John Higgins got out of the car, went over to the cooler, picked up a bottle of bourbon, and took plentiful slugs of bourbon, and then said, "I'll see you guys tomorrow morning." And went home to have to do the middle of the night.
It was rum.
It was.
Well, that's the absolute truth.
Off in his driving.
Well, you know,
he would not drive at night.
Days you couldn't see shit. Now they drive around you at Daytona. You don't even need headlights anymore.
Yeah.
And Sebring, you couldn't see. I couldn't see shit. And,
well, we got John a lap or two at Sebring in '86. The fab car broken down out on the track someplace, turn 9. So Ray Thacker, myself, and John hop in Ray. Where the car is, run across the track, and immediately start working on it, trying to get it to go. Chip Meade was driving the car. He'd left and already gone back to the pits, and we put a little tool.
Hello?
Breaking up.
Yep.
Yeah. Big time. Breaking up.
Well, those Sebring races
right
were
the end of the race, and he finished the race.
This is Tom Hessert. I remember those Sebring races going down that back runway from the airport, and the only thing that you could see was the reflectors in the concrete pavement, and if you missed it, you'd end up on the grass on the far side, and it'd take you about another half hour to get back on the track to know where the hell you were.
Yeah,
you know,
there was
no
light. James Brolin missed the turn out there and went off in the toolies and killed a pig. And they had him in the newspaper. Remember that?
I have heard that story. Jim Downing told me that story.
Killed a
pig. Yeah.
That's how far off and how dark it was back then. No lights whatsoever.
That place was scary.
Yeah, it was fast. When I was driving in '83 with Mike Meyer, we put a light out there that only we knew about, you know, on the apex, not the apex, but the turn-in spot, and one on the apex. So
that's good.
It was a crazy place, yeah.
Well, I remember Rothbard at the start of a race. He was in his 962. I think it was the first lap. Coming out of the last turn, he went over to the tire bales.
Up over the fence. He went over the fence, I think, didn't he? Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
He probably never paid the bill either.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I co-drove with him in '86, and we won Sebring. and we're in the interview room, and, you know, Hans Stuck's there and stuff. And so the guy asked him, what do you think of Sebring? And it was like his second race. And he said, oh, just another typical Sebring. And it's like, what did he know? It was his first race. You know, he was incredible. And my seat insert looked like a Barca lounger because I'm 5'7", and he's, what, 6'6", or something?
Yeah.
So I had a seat insert that looked like a, you know, like a lounge chair.
You know, I had the same thing. Charles Morgan and I raced together for a couple of years, and my seat I never knew what it was to have a right seat because I always sat up in the very front because Charles had to have it all the way back, and if it wasn't right, he couldn't take it. So I had to make this insert that was probably realistically a foot and a half thick. So I just luckily had my seatbelt around me.
Yeah, it was crazy days. When you guys
we didn't have that problem
car,
in Ball Brothers. Both balls were the same size.
Well, Brock had big balls, though, didn't he? And
he had to have big balls to drive at Ball Brothers.
I heard that coming. Yeah.
You know, I asked you once, Steve. I remember, I think it was 87 when you had the Spice, and I said, you have a Jiffy Lube store, right? And you said, yeah. And I said, how much does a Jiffy Lube store make? And you said, you know, if it's real good, it makes 60, 70 grand a year or something like that. And I said, how can you afford to go racing with the, you know, on 60, 70 grand a year? And he said, oh, I have 180 of them, yeah, or something like that.
No, the honest truth is we had 22 of them.
Yeah. It seemed like 80. That was pretty
cool.
But
we had a little help from Valvoline. We had a little help from Purolator. So, you know, we pieced it together. Rockman put up 15, 20 bucks. So
yeah, I was going to say.
We made it work.
You were lucky to go to McDonald's with Brock.
Yeah, he had the pockets on his jeans sewed shut, so there wouldn't be any even that chance of going in there.
He also invented the concept of leverage.
He also had that famous belt buckle.
Chip.
That belt buckle's still around. His wife has it. Jennifer has that belt buckle.
Wow.
Should bring it out at car shows.
You got a good
John,
point.
You're going to say Chip Mead was cheap, too? I didn't know that.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I mean, Chip and I, at one time, long story short, we were dating some girls that worked for an international travel company. And they said, look, we're all going to St. Thomas. If you guys want to just show up at the airport, just walk on the plane and tell them you work for this furnace company, and then we'll tell them that you do, and you can fly down with us, and we'll party. So Chip and I were living together then, and we drive up to the Columbus airport, and Chip's got, like, sunglasses, long hair. I said, Chip, you don't look like a furnace salesman, so you just shut up. And I'll talk us onto the plane. So we get to the Virgin Islands, and they all go to St. Thomas, or they go to San Juan, and Chip and I peter off, and we go over to St. Thomas. When we get there, Chip has got $3 in a Sahio credit card for the week.
Typical.
I said, where did you think we were going to stay, in a goddamn gas station? But that was Chip never ever thought about carrying a nickel for anything because it didn't happen. Somebody always paid for it. But he was the best driver among our pack anyway, for our group.
He was a good guy, but he was kind of grumpy all the time. Yeah.
Well, he was kind of the guy that weaved a lot of people together, though. Even today, you find out that Chip you know, Chip knew, Chip would like befriend a homeless person or the chairman of the board or a giant company. He didn't give a shit.
Hey, in 1988, Chip calls me up and he says, I got a young friend of mine wants to drive with you in Brockton at Daytona, and he'll chip in. And up walks this kid who we named Kid Ball, and says, hi, my name's Jay Cochran. And, you know, put him in the car, and I said, you know, do 5 laps and make sure you bring it back the way you took it out. He goes out in 5 laps. He's as quick as we are. We're about our third year in the car. And he's just as polite as he can be, Mr. Durst and Mr. Brockman. And we don't have a clue who he is. And after the race, he said, look, you know, why don't you guys come down and spend the weekend at the house? Gives us the address at Palm Beach. And we show up down there, and we turn into the driveway, and I'm about a quarter mile in, and I turn to Brockman. I said, there's something going on here. And we pull up to this 1880s or 90s vintage home that the original Henry Phipps had built on 18 acres in the middle of goddamn Palm Beach. And we wandered in, still clueless as to what was going on. There was a book about a foot thick on an old antique table, and called Halcyon Days. And it was a story one of the great aunts had written, the history of the Phipps family. And when I found out that, you know, his great-great-great-whatever grandfather was co-founder of U.S. Steel, I thought, now I understand.
No, you actually thought sponsorship pedal opportunity. Yeah, he
well,
was good.
Kid, I'll tell you, the kid could pedal a car, and he was a wonderful guy. Still,
and you know what?
He's
the only guy I've ever seen that was handsomer than Brock, you know?
He got a point. And kid was really special.
I think he ended up running off of Chip's girlfriend.
Well, that's all possible.
Jimmy, didn't he run off of Kathy? Didn't he run off of Kathy?
We didn't have a lot of rules around Ball Brothers.
Yeah, I think he did.
He ran off of Chip's girlfriend, took her to California or something.
So Cochran did?
Yeah.
Listen, I remember when Brockman was hustling the Kendall kid's mom. And I said, you got to draw the line there, Brock.
Oh, God.
Well, they got a divorce anyway, so it would have been fair game, yeah.
Well, I think he was looking to kind of accelerate the pace of that. There was no divorce going on when he stuck his nose in there.
Yeah, I remember when Brockman brought Stephanie Powers to a race, you know.
That was Road Atlanta.
Yeah.
Tell you a funny Brockman story.
I remember it.
We're at Sears Point. We're not doing very well. And the car catches fire, and Brockman bails out of the car and rolls on all along the ground. And the whole thing's on ESPN live. And about a week later, I'm down in Orlando at the humble little home where he grew up. And Ma Brockman is there. And she looks at me and she said, you know, Steve, I like you, boy, but I was watching that. And I was sure hoping that wasn't Michael rolling around on the ground.
only a mother could do that.
Exactly. Said, I understand, Mom.
Hey, this is a question to the Fab Car guys. How'd you ever decide to build your own car? And why? I mean, it seemed like a pretty big, big
we had two. We already had two sleds. I mean, complete sleds. So we couldn't go downhill.
Who decided to build an 1,850-pound Camel light car?
Well, originally, it ended up being 2,100 pounds anyway. So
You know, the original Fab car, Tom Winters had it built, and then they screwed it all up. Elliot Forbes Robinson drove that car first, and then I bought it when it was about 80 races old, and we got it up to Dayton, and the hell, the shocks were on upside down, and it was a mess. And then Dave Clem, who's an extremely talented car builder, had built Indy Lightnings. He did all the 962s that ever got wrecked. Dave Clem kind of fixed the tubs, did all the repairs. The car was okay, but it was kind of not state-of-the-art when it was new. And then Timmy McAdam decided we should build a second one. And Timmy actually built the second one. And then Timmy and Chip, I think, and Jack Baldwin was in there somehow. They built the big Fab car with the Chevy motor in it.
That's right. That was 88, I think, yeah.
Somehow burnt to the ground when it was in the storage by Tom Milner. Timmy never got paid for the car, and recently it started showing up at historic races.
Oh, yeah, it must have burned down about four or five times.
Yeah.
I think there was some insurance fraud in that. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Some?
If we had all the money that Milner owed, we would be... I could retire. I should have retired.
Well, luckily, yeah, he is retired now.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think there was some shenanigans he pulled with BMW and lost that deal because of he was, you know, so we shouldn't say it on public TV. Yeah.
There's been a lot of shenanigans in the road racing business.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I remember Elliot driving the Fab car at, I think it was Mid-Ohio, because I was in the same race. It must have been 85, maybe. Yeah.
He won the first race with it at Road Atlanta. And Al Holbert had actually done the original testing with the car. So it had, well, we still got the car. The car won three of the last four historic 24-hour races in 1920 and 21. Charlie Monk and I drove it once, and I drove it by myself the other two times. So,
sure gets around for only having 5 liters.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, it was a strong car, and it never broke. The thing never broke, hardly ever.
Never or hardly ever. Yeah.
Well, in your delicate hands, it's easy to understand why.
Well, we ran over 5,000 racing miles with that car in 1987.
Yeah, almost 6,000 with just the 42 card. And we ran both cars all 16 races, and we had 2 DNFs for accidents, no mechanical DNFs.
And those were all Howard. Howard did all that.
Oh, bullshit.
Howard cracked the climb rock in the opening lap. That was one of them. But
oh, that was
the second DNF in 87 was John at Mid-Ohio at the keyhole in the wet grass. The car accelerated into the guardrail, took the rear end off of it.
Well, Howard wrecked it at Miami because his parents showed up to watch him race. And he went upside down.
Well, that was practice. We fixed that car overnight and ran the next day.
The team fraternalism is impressive.
We got all the sponsorship from Andretti, you know, because he crashed in 962 in the same place. Very fortuitous.
And home, and
he should have called Mako.
We stayed up all night fixing the car.
Yeah. And then we put that, Ralph Sanchez paid us $10,000. To put all the grocery store bullshit all over the car because he paid the Andretti's and invited all those grocery people, and they didn't know the difference. And when they saw the car going around the track with me driving it, they thought for sure it was Mario Andretti.
Right.
Mario Johnson. Mario somebody. Wasn't it? Yeah, that was a good deal.
I tell you, this is Tom Hessert. But if you really think about it, how we're all friends now and laughing, but we surely did through all these times. We're friends and had a great time at every single race. I remember with John and Howard, we went to Gene's before the Daytona race, and John flicking butter on the ceiling in front of my son. My son's looking. But this is what you do when you go to a restaurant, little Tom. And then wham, there goes a spoonful of butter on the ceiling. And my son's head turning sideways, looking at me.
But how long before he did it at home? Did he ever do it at home, Tom? Did he ever do it at home?
No, luckily. No, my wife wouldn't let me do that at home. We knew better. He'd make me jump the whole ceiling.
We had, everybody had, now all these guys have got, Ray Hall and I were down at Daytona about 3 years ago for a 24-hour race. He invited me just to come down and hang out with him. They had.
Wait, he must have been desperate.
Well, he's always desperate. They had six Newell motor coaches for the trainers, for the team. And Ray Hall told me the year he won Daytona, he slept in his rental car.
Yeah. I remember the first time I went. This is Tom Hessert. I remember the first time I went to Daytona. I slept in the car also. That was my warmth at nighttime, and never even had a shower at that time. There was no lights back there either.
No.
Do
you remember that Daytona, like 82, 83, when they shut it down because of the fog?
I was the first car in line for that.
That was like in 89. Yeah. The fog rolled in.
Because everybody was missing the bus stop. They couldn't see it.
Yeah.
I couldn't see it for about an hour.
I couldn't see it because
I was
at
the back
hotel.
Of the truck that time. Yeah.
They red flagged it. Yeah.
You couldn't see hardly shit from the hotel window, but I heard about it.
Yeah, with Miss Sunbank.
That's right.
I don't think it slowed you down at all, Higgy.
That's right. Didn't bother me at all.
The rum bottle probably obscured your vision,
But he would always show up about 9 o'clock in the morning, and all freshened up, and you guys ready for me to go in?
That's right.
Yeah.
And he and John was fresh and ready to go.
Yeah, that's right. He's finishing up.
Hey, Don Bell, you drove with Brockman too, didn't you? Is Don Bell still there?
Yeah.
Maybe
I'm
not.
Here. You drove with
Mike Brockman too, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I drove with Brockman. 85, 84. Started off with Robert Overby, and then Brockman and I were together a year or two, and then Jeff Klein and I were together at least a couple of years. So you were talking about Stephanie Powers. I was co-driving with Brockman at Atlanta when he had Stephanie with him. And so there was this strange girl hanging around, and she was pretty good looking, but she hung out in the trailer, in the truck, all the time. So I just went on in there and changed clothes and changed into the driver's suit, back out again. And went all weekend like that, and I'm going back to the airport. And my wife said, "What do you think of Mike's new girlfriend?" I said, "Well, it's nice, pretty good." She said, "Don't you know who she is?" And I said, No, who is it?" She said, "Stephanie Powers." And I said, "Well, who is that?" And of course, I got an education pretty quickly. But yeah, we had some good times together. Caught him on a radio show in Tampa one time, and you know, between races, and he was doing an interview, and so I called him, and of course, didn't tell him who I was, but he was the
first
guy to drive with.
Here's another Brockman moment for you guys. I guess it was the first year of the Columbus street race, and the organizers of the race wanted to get the civic leaders, politicians, you know, behind everything so they could do it again. So they had a black tie reception out at the Galbraith's breeding farm, Darby Dan Farm, and they invited a GTP team, and they invited us as the representative Camel Light team, and it was specified black tie, and we went out and rented white Tom Johnson Miami Vice tuxedos, and we bought some black Reeboks, and we walk into this thing, and the governor's there, and the mayor, and all kinds of folks. And, you know, they all turned and looked at us, and you could see them, you know, speaking behind their cupped hands. And there came time to say a few words. And Brockman takes the microphone, and he very seriously, with a scowl on his face, scans the room from one end to the other and then back again. And there's this eerie silence. And he says, "Is it cool in here, or is it just us?" We were never invited to represent Camel Lights again.
Or anybody else.
As the Columbus 500 was a deal, like, you know, Ray Hall and Truman kind of, they kind of keynotes behind that. But it was King's. We had a big birthday party for James King there during the race. And we were in I can't remember what restaurant it was, but it was a white tablecloth, very nice restaurant with a lot of families in there having expensive dinners. And they brought the birthday cake to the table for James. And James stood up as we thought maybe he was going to thank everybody. But instead, he pulled his pants down and sat in the cake to put out the candles. people around us were mortified. King's just got his butt crack full of cake, and he sits back down and pulls his pants up.
Probably inspired Rothbard.
Yeah.
And there's... He always had Howard Sherry lighting his chest hair on fire.
I remember that.
Or maybe putting a Caesar salad in his shirt pocket in case he meets a bitch later that might want to party.
Higgy, you're telling stories here, Higgy.
Yeah. Nobody better than Howard in a bar full of vodka with a Caesar salad in his shirt pocket.
Very Italian of him.
You know, San Antonio was a fun race.
Really that was fun a great
San
race.
Antonio.
How about flat-out chicane where you had to go through the Jersey barriers flat out?
Yeah, about an inch.
If you missed, you died.
Yeah, well, we were Timmy and I both drove that race together. I drove myself there alone once by accident. It was 114 degrees at the start, and Howard and I were driving together. And, of course, we had been drunk all night like we always did. And I started the race, and it was getting really close for time for me to get out of the car. I was so goddamn hot, my legs hurt. You know, those old cool suits never worked. And there was a giant wreck just coming out of that chicane, and I couldn't go around the track, so I had to divert to the pit row. And Ray, our crew chief, started screaming, "Pit, pit."
and Howard was supposed to get in the car, and Howard was about 40 yards away from the car with his suit down around his waist with some chick he picked up at a bar.
He was always smarter than you.
They slid, they fueled the car and slammed it back down the ground. I drove that whole race alone, and it was so, my legs were cramped so bad. The last four or five laps, I had to hold the gas pedal down with my left foot because my legs had cramps in them so much from being in that hot-ass car. And by some weird circumstance, I ended up finishing second, which was the best race I ever did by myself. But I was so cramped up, I couldn't stand up to get out of the car.
Jeez. Don and I won that race. We thought it was an accomplishment. If you finished second by yourself in 114 degrees, we didn't do too much to win.
it was a hot place. And then once we were in Palm Beach, Chip had wrecked the shit out of the car, trying to qualify for the, which never was going to happen. And so they switched cars, and I got stuck into the Chip's car. And they were still putting the car together as we were rolling to the grid. And it had a vibration in it so bad, by the end of the race, the steering wheel had broken off. I had one yoke of the steering wheel left, and the clutch pedal had broken off the floor. That was a wonderful race. That was a well-prepped car.
What do you mean? Me and I won that race. Chip and I won that.
Well, yeah, in the car it wasn't all fucked up.
No wonder you guys partied so hard. Every race was going to be your last moment on Earth, it sounds like.
Well, we didn't have any choice. You know, we had, I don't know if you guys remember Jeff, our truck driver. But Jeff, our first big deal was Sebring, and Holbert asked us to get there on Wednesday to do a kind of a press day with the fab cars, and the truck didn't show up. And it finds out the truck's impounded in Tennessee at a weigh station because a drug-sniffing dog had found pot in my truck driver's suitcase. Now, we couldn't tell Al Holbert that we weren't there because our very first big team effort was an impounded marijuana deal. We had to wire $1,500 to get the truck out of impound, and we ended up getting to the track. But about the next couple races was Watkins Glen, and Jeff used to just smoke a pound of weed while he drove the truck. He got the truck stuck under the bridge entering Watkins Glen. And they had to let the air out of all 18 tires to get it low enough to pull it out. Traffic was backed up. So Holbert hired us a truck driver, and it turned out to be Jack McAfee. I don't know if any of you guys remember Jack McAfee or not, but in the 50s.
Oh, sure. Poor truck guy.
He drove the RSKs. He was like, you know, he drove with Kimberly's and Roger.
Yeah, he was very good.
And we didn't know him from jack shit. And they were flying him in from Portland or somewhere. He would drive our truck to the races and never say anything to us about being famous. So
he was probably humbled to be in your company.
He was, for sure.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
As were most people.
More like he was probably speechless. He was trying to talk, but he couldn't.
Yeah. Let's say, what are you putting that on there for? We don't know. We're showing the other part we have.
Actually owned a Porsche dealer in San Fernando Valley.
Our Volkswagen Porsche. But he was
a big deal. In the 50s, he was a big deal.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, he was.
He was a nice guy, hell of a nice guy.
Yeah.
And we didn't exactly have a Kenworth-style rig either.
What are you trying to say?
Well, yeah, you're better than the first truck. Jim Truman sold me a truck for $5,000. Guaranteed me it'd be perfect. We were going to California. We left Dayton, and it broke down in Indianapolis. That's 108 miles away.
We're at the Miami street race with the little Taiga, and I had Jim Hyman, the chairman and founder of Jiffy Lube, come down. He's walking around through the paddock, and there's all these big rigs, and we had a white dually Chevy pick-em-up truck and a featherlight trailer. And he says, you know what, why can't we have one of those rigs? And I said, step up, coach. And we got the first slope-nose Kenworth that the Gerhardts built, all AMG. Thing was unbelievable. I don't know if you guys remember it, but that thing would get down the highway at 100 miles an hour, and you could have a conversation just above a whisper. It was really something.
Yeah, trucks. We never really had a really good truck, I don't think. A lot of guys, you guys had, we had pretty good rigs. We always had shit.
This is Howard Sherry. Let me just tell you this first time this truck that Higgy was talking about. I'd gotten out of Atlantic, thought I was a pretty hot shoe. And so I hooked up with Higgy to race an RSR at Elkhart. And he arrives, his mechanics arrive in this straight truck. And they roll out of the truck, and they've been piping nitrous oxide into the cab for the last 200 miles. They were so stoned that they rolled out of the truck, and I looked at it, I thought, this is a team I'm going to be racing with, huh? And that's how that was my first race with Higgy.
They had a garden hose hooked up to a nitrous tank in the sleeper. And they would just hit the hose whenever they felt necessary.
That is wild.
Yeah,
wild.
We had a bunch of those old GTU cars for a while. And I remember once we had Jim Truman and me, and I think Chip were going to run at Sebring. And Jim Truman wrote me a check for $5,000, and it bounced. Red roof ends, the check bounced. And, you know, $5,000 then was like $50 million to me. And he eventually made good on the check, but I always thought that was pretty funny.
Should have framed that one.
We had a lot of adventures in those old Carreras, those early days. Those were fun.
Yeah. I'll tell you a guy that could pedal the Camel Lights car, but he's not on this call tonight. And I want to mention is David Loring.
Yeah, he was. You're right.
I'll tell you a story about David and Brockman again. We had won the first Columbus Street race in the little Taiga, and then we bought the Spikes. And we're running we're back at Columbus. And Brockman hated to start a race, hated it. And I hated him starting because he's kind of bonsai, and you go dropping, 15, 20 cars into turn one, turn two. There was no place for Brockman. So I just thought it would be better, I forget why, just driver matchups, that he started that race. So he starts, and he's got us, I don't know, I guess he's got us in first place, and I get in to finish. And I got like a 20-second lead, and with, I forget, 15, 20 laps to go. And Loring's got that car that he built, the Denali, and he's got him. And he's catching me at like half second to a second a lap, and Brockman's screaming into the radios, just incessantly driving me crazy. Finally, after he's got me down to about 7 seconds with three or four laps to go, and Brockman's telling me, he's cool and get on it, goddammit, he's catching you. And I said, why don't you shut the hell up? He's just a lot better than I am, you schmuck. and I turned the radios off. Thank God his Lori broke his transmission. We won the race. But I got fond memories of David Lori.
Yeah, he's
yeah.
Well,
yeah,
he was this is, I got it. This is Tom Hessert. I got the following year I drove with David in the Taiga. And he used to pride himself by not cleaning his fire suit. And never and priding on how old his helmet was. So one of the races, I had to, my helmet broke, and I had to borrow David's helmet. And I was, like, thoroughly disgusted. I can't believe I got to put this on my head. I put 3 head socks on before I put his helmet on. So his helmet wouldn't touch my skin. I used to get in and out of that car. You did, John, you talk about Howard and what he would do. David would love to stink up my car, his car, and then I'd have to get in there afterwards. And it was like, oh, my God, I can't believe it. I almost left the door open half the time.
I don't think – I would bet you that David Loring never, ever, ever washed a driving suit all the years he raced.
No, he had pride. He had pride in that. Nothing. He didn't even put it in the creek at Lime Rock to let it like air itself out because he figured it'd kill all the fish, you know, in the stream. But he was
nope.
Disgusted.
Yeah.
But you know, one thing that he did his hands. He used to chop wood all the time because he lived up in Maine or Vermont or something. And New Hampshire, and he used to have to cut wood all summer long to have it for the wintertime. And his hands were like 5 times the size of mine, and it was they were like rocks. He was.
I remember that
big guy. Yep.
Yes, he was.
Did he move to Alaska?
Yeah, he lived in Denali National Park. That's where he got the name for the quarry built.
And you know why
he moved back there after he quit racing? He moved. He moved back there, and he was, like, flying bush planes or something like that.
Yep. He told me the story that he got beat out of his ride in England. He won the championship or something. They were supposed to give him a free ride, and they said, too bad. We don't have the money. Go home. So he went dejected, went up to Alaska. So one time I had a conversation with him. I said, David, you were up in Alaska. What did you do for a shower? He goes, Tom, don't you know? You know, after a week or two, I said, didn't your hair get greasy, dirty, didn't you smell? He goes, and after a week or two, you never made any difference. It was all okay. And even when he came back, he still never washed his head or body.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to have to interrupt here. We got to do a station identification. Hang on.
Oh, hell, we're on a roll.
I know it. It's gross, I have to say. I am totally grossed out. I am not going to sit in a beer keg or anything, or a birthday cake or whatever. Ah, I'm ruined for life here, y'all. Okay,
yeah.
This, believe me, I'm almost embarrassed to say this is Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. All our shows are recorded, and somebody's got to stop moving their phone around. Mute your phone. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com or archive.org. Ah, goodness gracious, y'all. Y'all got some dirt. Don't they got dirt? They got serious dirt. We want to hear some more dirt. Yeah, we'll listen to some more.
Well, on the subject of David Loring, he drove with Pierre Honegger, right? And
yes.
And I think Pierre kind of financed it because David never had a dime. And And everything, it was always like it was stuck together with chewing gum. You know, the thing always broke, but it was fast. I mean, he was fast, so he probably carried the car.
And David could pedal.
Yeah. Pierre Honegger at the Le Mans Classic several years ago, and he was driving some pre-war car, and it was just hanging together, too. You know, they look like two peas in a pod, the two of those guys, except Pierre couldn't drive and David could.
Correct.
Yeah, David was world class, I think.
Yeah. Pierre had a BMW store in Princeton.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah,
a BMW
Honda, too,
Honda
think,
store.
If I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Yep.
He was David's man, without a doubt. And then when they used to run that Peking in China, that rally racing that he used to do, he and Pierre used to do that every year for a number of years.
Peking somewhere in Europe, yeah.
Yep,
well,
that's what he would do.
Then when David resurfaced in vintage, he came back with that kind of scary guy. I forget his name. Guy that had the spice for the Cosworth in it.
Who is
that?
I don't know. Costas
once?
Yeah, Costas. I still talk to Costas once in a while. He lives over
really?
In Europe. Yeah, he's doing fine, and he's got married. I think he has one or two children. He lived in Monte Carlo, then he lived in London. Now I think he lives in Switzerland now.
Well, he's probably practicing for a job interview, you think?
Yeah. Hey, you know, I was friends with Costas. And I, one day we were driving somewhere, and I said, Costas, you know, I know your family's in the shipping business. I said, you know, the only guy I ever knew was Onassis. I never knew him, but I knew his name. And I said, you know, what is it like between you, your family, and Onassis? He goes, that Onassis is a scow. He buys the worst ships and the worst things, and he just runs them into the ground. I said, well, how many does he have? He goes, he got 15 to 20. And I said, how many do you have? He goes 30 to 40, and then he married a lady that had about 100 of them. And but he was always a great guy, Costas, and very, very nice.
Yeah, he was. I drove about 10 races with him in 1989, and he was pretty quick, and he was such a nice guy. And had some interesting friends he used to bring along.
And, I raced in Le Mans in 87 with him. That's when I first met him. And we ended up third in C2 together and ninth overall.
That's great.
And then I raced in Canada with him, Japan, and Mexico at the same time. It was great.
Wow. Any sex?
This is Don. He drove with us at Daytona one year. And the next day, the Daytona newspaper, Daytona News, whatever it was, had a picture of our car right at the end of the race with flames coming out of the back end, about 30 feet tall. I mean, it was serious. And it was Costas in the car. And every time he came in the whole weekend, he'd come in and somebody would open the door for him. And so he was able to get the car in, but he got it in and the thing is going up in flames big time. And he didn't know how to open the door of the Argo. So he's sitting in there waiting for somebody to come up and open the door, which finally somebody did and got him out of there. It was scary,
oh my!
Man.
Oh wow!
He and I drove in
85 or so.
In 89, we did, like I said, 9 or 10 races together, and Dieter Questa drove with us at Daytona, and then Dieter was supposed to drive with us at Sebring. And he drank a Coke and somehow got a piece of plastic from the can, from the plastic cup, and drank it. And he was like, he had a drop. He couldn't drive the race. He was having some stomach trouble as this piece of plastic made its way through. Dieter Questa is one of the nicest people you ever meet. And, you know, I think Costas was too. He's a good guy.
Didn't Dieter Questa bring in the first time you ever saw Red Bull? Wasn't he part of Red Bull to begin with or friends with him?
I think so, because he's from Austria, and the guy Manischitz, I think that's how you pronounce his name, the guy who owns Red Bull or owns the European Red Bull, he's Austrian also. And I think there was a reason. I think you're absolutely right. You know, he always had a deal.
We brought in Hawaiian shopping and all those stripper stanks.
Oh, I remember them.
That's a lot better than Red Bull.
Yeah.
I would say, you brought the Hawaiians in, John.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was
I think I was with the wrong team, it sounds like.
Well,
I remember some paddocks with that group, yes.
Howard Jerry knew every one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He gave that big Iowa smile.
How did Howard learn to be such a player when he lived in Iowa, for God's sake?
Well, he didn't live there. He owned it.
Yeah.
Well, Howard had to do something living in Iowa.
Sheep. Big sheep.
No. Yeah. Now, no. Watch out.
little barnyard humor.
I remember San Antonio Grand Prix in 88, and Downing and I were fighting back and forth for the championship, and I figured I have to do something to him. I have to do something to, like, psych him out. So I hired a belly dancer to go over to him before the race and did a belly dance for about 5-10 minutes trying to psych him out for the race.
Didn't work either, did it?
What you should have done, Tom, was get Rothbart to cross-dress and go do that. That would have done it.
I have been trying ever since we started these shows to get Jim to come on the show, and he will not do it.
He's way too hard for that.
If you show him this one, and you tell him about the Camel Light guy, he'll probably come in with everybody.
Either that or I'll get fired.
You know, I've worked
for Jim for a long, long time.
Jim Downing built all the body work for the Fab cars, and he owned the molds. He would never sell us the molds. And his theory was, I've got the molds, and you've got the car, and you're my only customer, and I'm your only supplier.
That's right.
About three years ago, he was moving his shop, and he offered me all those molds. And I didn't go get them. He threw them away.
Yeah, he did. He didn't close the shop. He just closed the composite shop.
Yeah.
So,
Jim and I actually formed the Camel Light Drivers Association.
I know.
Collected money from everybody so we could put somebody in the TV booth to talk about Camel Light. I can't remember who it was.
I'd like to know. Now tell me, because I didn't recognize the voice. Who was it? They ordered the belly dancer.
Tom Hester.
Okay. I'll tell him tomorrow.
Yeah, I figured that was clean enough that he could do it in the paddock area.
I doubt you got the response you wanted.
Yes.
Probably he'd have a better response if he had some sort of derelict sports car in front of him that he could buy and sell for a profit, you know.
You got that right.
Well, definitely.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. I never know what's going to be over there when I come in on a Monday or Tuesday. Some really strange things show up over there.
Well, I still remember this, Tom Ezra. I still remember sending the belly dancer over and Jim having this bewildered look on his face, eating his banana and his peanut butter sandwich that he did before every race. Just kept on going and didn't miss a beat.
He still does it every day. He has his PB&J and banana every day.
Yep.
Boy.
He surely
no
didn't put any weight on.
Pounds.
Yeah, he didn't put any weight on himself.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. He's a very good guy.
Yeah.
I would like to have added Parker Johnstone to this group. but I don't know how to reach him.
He's not that Parker might have been the only. He might have been the only real race car driver out of all of us. No,
he was something else to watch.
He had the factory Acura. Yeah, he had the factory Acura team, and he had a real team doing that stuff. That was
a beautiful car. That was a wonderful car. I wonder where all those are now.
I drove that car in vintage racing probably 15 times. A guy named Mark Rich owned it for a long time. Yeah.
And then I remember the Whitehall the cars being built over at Fab Car. Fab Car was in my hometown along with a lot of other people. And we had a lot of fun watching those cars.
We ended up with.
Yeah. I was doing a vintage race somewhere in California here, and Tom Winters came up.
And, oh, really?
And, yeah, he's maybe 5 years ago or something, so he's still around.
Wasn't he in some kind of a shopping center developer or something?
Yeah, he was a real estate developer.
Yeah.
He and Bill Cole, you know.
Bill Cole, that's right. Is Bill Cole still around?
He's in Spokane, Washington. I haven't talked to him in a couple years, but
he was a home builder, wasn't he?
Yeah. His family builds like mega office complexes out here. And he's like a nephew or something. You're right, he built homes. Yeah. So he's still around. And, who else? Rothbart used to call me all the time when he was driving somewhere, like to pick up the kids or something. I was his entertainment. Finally, I was so happy when we got caller ID, you know.
Very good, Klein.
Yeah.
Let me add a little bit to that view of Rothbart. Rothbart continually offered me $300,000 for this season for Brockman's seat, and I opted to turn down the $300,000 rather than co-drive with him, which will I thought he wasn't good for the ball image.
No. although his balls would be right in your face, considering they're tight, you know.
Well, can you see us chasing ladies with Rothbart in tow?
He was creepy.
He'd have to drive the tow truck without a doubt.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
one day after
you
driving with Rothbart, a truck pulls up at my house and unloads a VCR, a satellite, one of those 6-foot satellite dishes, a satellite receiver, all this stuff. He was a very generous guy, you know. And, of course, I had to put it all together. There was about 8,000 little bolts, but nuts and bolts. But he was a generous guy. He was worth a laugh, but he was a pretty generous guy.
Matter of fact,
did any
I put one in.
Did any of you guys witness his pre-race drunken situation at Del Mar where he sat down in Peg Bishop's lap at the dinner table and went on for like a half an hour? It was a complete uproar. And I thought he was in trouble. But anyhow, he somehow lurched to his room. And he started to race the next day, and he wouldn't get out of the car halfway. Charlie Morgan never got in the car, and he won the race. It was the only way he could save the situation. He was such a mess the night before, and he goes out and wins the damn race. I think Ray Hall helped him, because Ray Hall knocked about 4 Camel Light cars off course with that goddamn John Deere front end of that 962 he drove.
Yeah, I heard Pam Meadows slipped him Pam Bishop's phone number. Mrs. Bishop didn't really mind that much. Yeah,
she was a good sport, but But I mean, imagine this, you know, lurch sitting in your lap for half an hour, drunk as the Lord. I mean, it was a horror show.
Yeah. Pam Meadows was another one of Chip Mead's dream girls. And we were at Palm Beach or some Miami or one year. Jimmy and I and Howard, I think it's Chip, were leaning on the pit rail about 10 minutes before the race started. And Chip had about a 3-pound booger hanging out of his nose and didn't know it. And Pam, he'd been trying to hit on Pam Meadows for the whole season, and she started walking up to us, and none of us said one thing to Chip. And she came up to Chip, and she kept averting her eyes away, and she kind of walked off. And I said, Chip, you know, that conversation probably would have gone a little better for you if you didn't have a ball bat booger hanging out of your nose like that. That was great. He couldn't figure out why she was being so inattentive.
Where's Pam Meadows now? Who knows where Pam Meadows is now?
Oh, I don't know.
I did. I wouldn't admit it.
I don't know.
Wasn't the rumor that she went out with Brabham for a while?
Oh, shit.
I don't know.
Who knows?
We never set our standards that high.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
As Camel Light guys, we weren't as high as that.
No, we were after the 3 o'clock in the morning bar checks.
Yeah. That little stocky girl that worked for Goodyear changing tires, that was our speed.
That's right. And, Bob Schaefer, he was a great guy.
Bob Schaefer. Yeah, Bob was a good guy.
He was terrific.
He could play good golf.
Yeah, okay, let's wrap this up. We'll do it again.
Okay.
Already?
Are you getting rid of us already?
What if we're not ready to go?
Yeah, I'm not ready to go.
We want to start our own show.
We got to do this again. It's just like we're back in the day. We're getting thrown out of another place.
Thanks again, guys.
Boys, I would tell you, I appreciate the chit chat with you boys, and it's been fun for me. So I hope you guys all. I don't really give a shit what you guys do, to tell you the truth, but I hope you guys all stay healthy and enjoy yourselves.
All right. We'll,
likewise.
Pulling for you.
Don't hang up. I gotta close it out. Just give me a minute here. Oh my goodness, that took me by surprise as well. Is everybody happy?
Absolutely. Thank you very much for putting this together.
Yep. Thank you. This time
thank you.
And I thanks for the great stories, and to our audience, thanks for listening. We did have an audience. You did remember we had an audience, right? All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Product website. Ta-da! And now for some really big news. Get ready. Our next show is Wednesday, February 23rd, 6 p.m. Eastern, Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. We'll feature a bunch of guys just talking racing, just like you, but they will be doing it with British accents. We'll have John.
They invented racing, so it's okay.
I think you're right. I know you're right. I'll invite you to come on and tell them that. Okay?
You mean Steve Durst can do an English accent?
I can if I have to, but I still have to say y'all. John Fitzpatrick, David Hobbs, Brian Redman, and Derek Bell. Among the four of them, they probably won more races than anyone on the planet.
They didn't
they don't have
fun
the stories we got.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
You're right. It will not. They won't do dirt. If they do dirt, they do it with the pinky race, you know.
Those guys never drank and got naked.
Probably not. repair mechanics did, you know.
Hey, anybody can win a race. Takes a real man to make bail.
Not just crying.
Where did you get that? That is hilarious.
That's just something I sunk up.
Well, you're doing good. I hope we can do.
Says good night.
Hope we can do this again. Y'all have just been a lot of. You've been a lot of fun, and I can visualize the cars each one of you drove.
Good night.
Because I was there too.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night,
y'all.